This is kind of a weird Tomes of Magic, and it's the first in a pair of episodes where Adam and I read all three Werewolf the Apocalypse Umbra books. And it was a lot. This episode focuses on an overview of each of the three books, the Kami, which are the Gaian spirits introduced in Werewolf 20, as well as how to integrate werewolf stuff more into a Mage 20th game. Our next episode will be on the places in the Umbra that Werewolf has and how to use those in a Mage game. But with that, on with the show.
Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Simpson, joined today by co-host Terry Robinson. What is Harry? Smells like wet dog and can make a mess of your living room if you aren't careful. The Middle Umbra, of course. Whereas the High Umbra is a realm of daydreams, concepts, and mysterious powers, the Middle Umbra is a realm of dirt, sweat, and animal spirits so ancient and so savage you won't be inviting them to tea anytime soon. If you're the kind of storyteller who relishes the thought of dropping your players into the Middle Umbra with only a knapsack and some bear repellent, where do you get material to help your games? Book of Worlds gives us a brief look at seven realms. Infinite Tapestry tells us on page 25 to read Umbra, a book for Werewolf Revised Edition. So we did. In fact, we read all three editions of it. After reading 455 pages, I've got a few things to say, but before I do, Terry, how are you? Any announcements for us?
You didn't say the line, Adam. You didn't say working hard towards ascension so you don't have to. How are people going to know it's you?
Oh.
It's okay. It's been a while. In fact, it's been so long since you and I have recorded, my hairline has moved back and yours is gray. Wait. That's the way it's always been.
You just told everybody about my gray hair. Now I'm not hip
it's
anymore.
It's so thick and rich, it's infuriating. When people are like, oh no, my hair is going gray. Like, I'm sorry, the Rapunzel-like mop that you have on the top of your head that has the ability to soak ag damage, that's how thick and rich it is, has changed color, where my head looks like the beach line of Cape May, New Jersey, gradually receding into nothingness. So people are like, oh, you're cutting your hair short. I'm like, yes, as I have less, I make it shorter so it's not so obvious that there's nothing there. And temporarily, I didn't have a beard. So people are like, oh, look at that giant mathematical man baby walking around the company. So, but no.
Sorry, you're too hard on yourself. Yeah,
call them as I see it. This is the curse of high doubts and perception. hopefully all of our executive producers will have heard the episode I did with Monica Speca talking about some of the upcoming projects. So if you're interested in knowing what's on background for that, please listen to this. I'm not quite sure where this will go out, probably March or April, but Visions and Vistas, the Book of the Umbra that Mates the Podcast is putting together, I am rapidly receiving first drafts and correcting them and giving notes as I do. And that's about all for me.
All right. Well, today we are looking at three books for Werewolf the Apocalypse and talking about how they can help our mage games. Terry, can you start a walkthrough for us?
Start a walkthrough for three books. You don't pay me enough to do that.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess a walkthrough of these three books would take a long time and cover a lot of the same material three times. Instead, I'm going to give a summary and point out some things I noticed reading through them. A number of things will be left out, but these are werewolf books, so some of the material doesn't apply well to mages anyway. The first and third books are called Umbra, the Velvet Shadow. The second book is just Umbra. There are three editions, but it's the same book each time. Each is close to 150 pages. The first came out in 1993, the second in 2001 for Werewolf Revised Edition, and the third in 2014 for Werewolf 20.
Were you thrown off by that? Because in Mage, all the 20th anniversary editions are huge. So when I was going through this, I'm like, well, the 1993 book was like 50 pages, and the 2001 book was like 150 pages. Obviously, the 20th anniversary edition is going to be three. No, it's roughly the same size. Jerks. So
yeah, you're right. I'm used to the later editions having multiple
these
authors
door
and,
stops.
And more to give
yeah.
us, but. Yeah, too often the case with Mage 20 books, they get enthusiastic and they give us, let's just say, a lot. But these three books, it was pretty close to 150 pages. The third book veered into like 160-something pages. Like, whoa, guys, 10 extra pages. Calm down here. But werewolves call the Middle Umbra the Umbra. When theurges, the shamans of werewolves, get specific, they call the Middle Umbra the Near Umbra. Werewolves recognize the deep umbra and umbral zones. They sometimes speak of odd corners of the near umbra called the astral umbra, that's the high umbra, and the dark umbra, that's the low umbra. They rarely visit those places, though, and don't have a lot to say about them. If you want to do a crossover, the Stargazer tribe of the werewolves know more about the high umbra than the other tribes. The Silent Striders tribe know more about the low umbra than the other tribes. But still, these three books did not give us a lot of page count talking about the astral and dark umbrae. These three books cover the umbra as a whole for werewolves. Other books for werewolf talk about Malpheus, the realm of evil and corruption. A book from 1999 focuses on the ethereal realm, and there's one or more books on the Weaver, which is the giant spider stasis spirit in Werewolf the Apocalypse. We may discuss those later, depending on how well they would help Mage Games. Although organization varies a little, each of these books features cosmology of the Umbra, such as Penumbra, Zones, Deep Umbra, and how werewolves move around there. We get the realms of the Middle Umbra three times. Each has a chapter on spirits. The first two have a chapter on storytelling. The third book takes some storytelling notes and puts them in the introduction. The first two books have an appendix where they give rules info for werewolf powers, spirit stats, etc. The third book mixes that material into the previous chapters, so it can take a chapter to focus on kami. More on them later. The first book from 1993 was for Werewolf's first edition. Mage Cosmology owes this book a debt. Book of Worlds Chapter 2 describes seven realms in the Middle Umbra. Those were taken from the near realms of this book. We'll discuss those realms later, but I will say the realms that were renamed for Book of Worlds get a larger word count here. There are reasons to visit and things to carry away when you leave. That makes them worth a look. The appendix features a magic trench coat. The early 90s World of Darkness was trench coat heavy. Hey buddy, want to see what's in my magic trench coat? When you hear that, you know you're in the wrong gaming group. This book gave us the first werewolf that is also a mummy. Weepowet, or however you pronounce that, cannot leave the Umbra, but he helps out Silent Striders and other werewolves. This book spends too much time on the Dream Zone and the computer web that is a part of the Cyber Realm. It's sort of like the Internet of the Cyber Realm, which is a realm in the Middle Umbra. Besides that, hats off to the authors for many great ideas that started here. Terry, your thoughts on the 93 book?
This was a super fun book. I even have a quote for it. In an ancient time that once existed but now never was, the spirit world and the physical world were one and the same. They were cut from the same fabric. They were the whole cloth. I've talked to Harry Heckel, the person who wrote this along with Dan Greenberg, about his view of kind of what the early Umbra was, and that weird notion of retro causality, that belief could kind of rewrite itself, the line, in an ancient time that once existed but now never was, I think gives a really interesting comparison of how werewolf kind of views time and causality versus mage and its relationship with the mythic. I like the idea. There's a bunch of subtle differences. I forgot that in Werewolf, Space Station Mir was a cairn. I think we need more space cairns. This book was very informed. This book was so fixed on you need to go to a place and get a thing to do a cool thing, and here are all the encounters. And I just love it. It's such a breath of fresh air from pages of vague philosophical text about what may or may not happen. So it's like, hey, make a roll to get there. For each success less than 5, you need to pick an encounter. Here are 10. I don't want to have to use it, but oh man, if I'm a storyteller in a hurry that wants to keep the Umbra weird and exciting, I think it's great. It was weird seeing that 1E terminology that wouldn't have flied, like mini realms. You're like, wait, what? And then it's like, realm system. I'm like, what? Some of the weirder spirits. I like the idea that they said every embodiment of technology needs to look like a web. We also see a bunch of umbral aspects that get picked up in Mage, but were kind of dropped from Werewolf. Like, for instance, vistas never really became big, and that's in here. The umbral wind never quite gets used again. I like that in this book, it calls the Null Zone the backstage of reality and attributes that to the Fianna, and in Mage it's attributed to someone else, and I couldn't remember who off the top of my head. Surprisingly readable book for something that's first edition. So if you find a used copy for $2, grab the darn thing. It's fun. And it's just good. Like when you and I were reading Mummy first edition, we're like, this is very well written. Even if the ideas aren't completely coherent and don't persist forward, the writing's good. And Mummy Werewolf, who doesn't want a Mummy Werewolf?
Yeah, I guess over the years of reading these books and discussing all the mage books, I kind of forgot how specific Werewolf was when it talked about places in the Umbra. You go here for this reason, you get this thing, and when you get back, it serves this purpose, and you'll notice this difference. And that's sometimes a little too specific, but you know, it really is refreshing. Yeah. Whereas with Mage, it's like, there's this vague, interesting thing over here, and who knows? Yeah. Now let's move on. It's like, well, could we have something concrete
before we move on? This is a rock that will help you kill God. And you're like, oh, okay, that is remarkably specific. And it used the term double aggravated damage. I don't know what that is, but it's in there.
I must have forgotten.
Yeah,
that
there's
passage.
A spear, yeah, that does double aggravated damage. It's like super angry. It's like, this acid is on fire and also made of silver. And you're like, oh, okay, that's all of them.
Well, the second book came out in 2001 and had two jobs. It had to adjust the material for the new rules of revised edition, Werewolf, that is. It also needed to change the setting for the End Times metaplot that was a part of all revised edition World of Darkness games. We learn werewolves also use the word Tellurian, just like mages do. Werewolves in the Penumbra can see which people are mages. As a storyteller, I would clarify mages only stand out when they have more than three quintessence in their body. You can call that a house rule. Page 17 describes what happens when a werewolf gets stuck trying to step sideways from Earth to the Penumbra. This sounds suspiciously like a Paradox Realm. And this was written in 2001, when we'd been hearing about Paradox Realms for a while. Werewolves believe their dead do not ever go to the Low Umbra. A sidebar on page 26 states, Horizon Realms are for cowards. Not sure I agree with that. Page 125 tells us the Umbra shouldn't be used as an escape hatch. I agree, but there are several examples in these three books of werewolves doing just that. I think the werewolf writers needed to compare notes. Page 128 suggests an umbral location could alter or operate differently if the players show behavior that go against the location's theme or mood. That is an idea I'd like to explore further. They did not give systems, but I'm motivated to try to come up with some of my own. The storyteller chapter for the second book was an improvement on the first book. The writing in this book was quite good. The authors did not waste time and expressed their points well. Terry, what did you think of the 2001 book?
This is automatically the best because it has Rebecca Gwegg cover art to it. I just love her artistic style. This was clearly for a Changeling supplement, and then there was some terrible mistake, and it gave us this cover. Also, again, this is interesting because it was written by Rob Hatch and Brian Campbell, so it's like this book brought to you by the Technocracy guy. It was also weird to see the 1E book and see no Ron Spencer in it, because that's always the artist I associated with Werewolf. But here, it's like Ron Spencer hadn't really been added to the roster of White Wolf at the time. But here, all the art is Ron Spencer and Richard Kane Ferguson. I find it wild that Ron Spencer works in ballpoint pen. That's amazing to me. Those just visceral, in a literal sense, art pieces. I like that it makes mention that there are other near Penumbra and what that could possibly mean. It gives advice on how to reskin spirits so that every time you encounter a particular one, it looks kind of different, which I like. This book, I think, had a lot of good information on elementals, if that's a thing that you're interested in. It's like, hey, what does a plastic elemental look like? What does an electricity elemental look like? There was an emphasis on pacting, which I thought was interesting. The idea that one of the reasons you would go to the Umbra is to visit spirits on their home courts to make agreements that you could then bring back with you. And again, this one is perfectly fine. Less of a emphasis on why you're in a place. Oh, the other thing I liked about the 1E1 was everything had a map. That was great. We need to bring back maps, make maps cool again. So quotes that stuck out to me in this one were, one, under the recommended reading section, it's like, Book of Worlds, while heavily rooted in mage cosmology, expect contradictions with the way things work in Werewolf. It may provide some ideas for stories that range significantly further afield. I'm like, inconsistent and weird. That's my baby. Yay, mage. The other one was talking about the Bonar's tribal homeland, where it says, here, dumpsters overflow with fattening edible junk. Cheap restaurants are open all night. The pitchers are a dollar. If that, the strippers are easy. And if you can find a quarter or a place to sleep, and you can find a quarter or a place to sleep just by looking down. I was just waiting for Harry McClintock's Big Rock Candy Mountain to just start playing as I was going through that section. And you're like, okay, this really gets to the heart. I would love to see tribal homelands for like the traditions, because it shows what is really important to the group. And it's just like the hermetic homeland, you can just argue all day and you don't even have to sleep. You can just keep arguing and disagreeing with people and fighting. And you're like, oh, wow, that's a really interesting view into what your group thinks is important and vital. Yeah, how about that? I did a walkthrough of the 2001 Umbra book with Josh Heath on Werewolf the Podcast, which I will include in the show notes. And we take that one. Josh does not do book reviews in the same way that we do. So when I rolled up and I just had a complete outline of the book, I'm like, we're going chapter by chapter, right? He's like, we can. So I'm like, time to get Mage the Podcast all up in Werewolf the Podcast. So if you're interested in a very detailed walkthrough of that book, link is in the show notes.
The two great tastes that take careful measuring before you mix them together.
Yeah, exactly. Baking soda and vinegar. You don't want to get that one wrong.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I haven't heard that episode yet. I have to look for that. Now, the third book came out in 2014. The table of contents is so nice, they are spoiling storytellers. The chapter one author likes to write, a little too wordy for my tastes. However, this is the best write-up of Glenn's I have ever seen. Glen is actually a game term. It is a place that appears in both werewolf and mage books. Glens are places in the penumbra where nature fills the place. The place is beautiful and peaceful. This write-up describes improvements for healing in a glen and the negative effects they can have on those who stay there too long. Trods are places on Earth where, in the first book, we are told changelings or fairies used to be there, but they are not there anymore, and now they're these abandoned, mysterious places. Well, in the 2014 book, trods are no longer places where the fae used to have influence. They are now places of active changeling power. They can be traps for the unwary. The werewolf right for resisting a trod is, I think, too powerful. Werewolves are strong enough without a level 3 right that lets them bulldoze changeling strongholds. Space is given to describe Hashima Island off the coast of Japan. It sounds interesting, but after reading it, what is the motivation for players to go there? That I just did not see. After all these years of passing mentions, Chapter 2 finally describes the space in the Middle Umbra away from the penumbra, but between realms. I had always thought of it this way, so I'm pleased the author agreed with my impressions on that. Chapter 3 gives us two examples of minor realms. Minor realms, of course, are small, perhaps temporary realms that storytellers are supposed to invent for their own games. They were mentioned before, but no examples given. I like what they're trying to do with examples, but I think these are not the best examples. Realms that form in the Umbra should have something to do with the world or common ideas or society. Search Engine is just a website pretending to be an umbral realm, while Synesthesia is so self-focused that it just doesn't stick the landing for me. A lot of space in Chapter 3 is spent on the Deep Umbra and how to get there, but werewolves don't have a lot of motivation to go there. There's just a vague reference about how it's a wilderness and werewolves can explore and see what's there. And that's all we get in terms of motivation, but we get really detailed information about how to get there. So I thought that was a little odd. We get a story idea for the Deep Umbra called Abandoned Post, about trying to find the Incarna spirit for Pluto, planet Pluto, who has disappeared because Pluto isn't considered a planet anymore by astronomers, a change that I believe happened in 2008. This gets too close to paradigm engineering for me. Werewolves shouldn't worry about what regular humans think of the werewolves' great spirits. As a whole, this book made repeated mentions of mages who work in the dreams of ordinary people. This sounded cool, but the mage books don't back this up very well.
We've literally never gotten no neuromancy. It's available for sorcerers, and that's it.
Yes, exactly. That was my thought. It was like, wow, this sounds like a really cool thing to go read in mage books, but you can't because it's not in the mage books, at least not for regular sphere using mages. So a bit of a disappointment, but hey, we've got a fan community that can write things for Storyteller's Vault, and we can make it happen. Of the three, this book has the highest page count, but gives the least space to the near realms, the Middle Umbra realms. That was a lost opportunity. Large portions of this book were a thin reskin of the 2001 book. I read it right after the 2001 book, and I often felt like I was reading the same book again. It was odd to see the Cyber Realm's computer web discussed as if it were the Earth's internet. Before we talk about Kami, Terry, what are your thoughts on the 2014 book?
This was a good book, and a lot. This book emphasized more unique spirits. If you want spirit of a city tree or a city totem or an embodiment of the pop culture understanding of America or a flame war, the spirits in here are much more abstract than in the other books. Like in 93 Umbra, it's like, here's the spirit of a rock. In 2001, it's like, here's the spirit of an interesting rock. In 2014, here's the spirit of a rock that was used to smash a window during a protest, and it has particular feelings about the band Arcade Fire. And you're like, oh yeah, those are three different takes on this. It talks a little bit more about the Celestines than other books, so if you're really interested in that upper range, I think it does a really good walkthrough of how werewolves view spirits. The mini realms, it's kind of interesting because like the mini realms that they gave us examples of, like Search Engine, felt like they took the place of in Mage Epiphanies from the High Umbra, where it's like, okay, there's a place that does this particular thing that could be useful to the group, but werewolves don't really go to the High Umbra, so what do? And it's like, da-da-da, mini realm. It explains anchorheads in detail, which I appreciated. These are the passageways that are used to get past the horizon. And in Mage, it's just like, these are guarded by powerful things. Some of them look like sponges. And you're like, okay. And here in Werewolf, we get a really good rundown of what they can look like, how they're guarded. It made me really feel jealous of the way werewolves are like, well, we don't want to give people this power all the time in all cases. Let's just make it a particular rite that they have to learn. And you're like, oh, that's a pretty good technology to kind of bound power. It would be like in Mage, it's hard to give someone the ability to just go from point A to point B and just those 2 points, because Correspondence 3 is like, well, once you got it, you can go anywhere all the time. So I certainly appreciate that. I did think it was cute when they talked about Pluto being demoted in 2006 and just the Celestine being like, oh man, this sucks, and just kind of wandering around. There are a lot more pouty, very powerful spirits seemingly in Werewolf than I would have anticipated. This book is a lot richer with plot hooks. It is very interested in having your characters do something, which is great for werewolf, but a lot of those don't apply for mage. So after the first couple times when I was reading plot hooks, I just kind of glance at the first one and be like, yep, this is werewolf stuff, where it's like, you need to get the sept to moot at a moon bridge, or the Galliard stargazer will thurge a clave. And you're like, I don't know what any of this dork stuff is. And I kind of went on from there. So that was my experience. I don't think you can go wrong with any of them. Like, that to me is kind of the takeaway. Like, none of these are bad. If you have access to any of them, that's great. Grab one, thumb through. My other takeaway was all of them kind of need to be supplemented by Axis Mundi, which Adam and I did a show on. And that one is just spirits. So many spirits. The spirits don't stock. And I the weird chess playing mantis creatures live rent free in my head.
Actually mine too. Exactly. Whenever somebody says Axis Mundi, I think of them.
Not a week goes by when I don't think of the weird monkish mantis creatures that really like playing chess. Quote that stood out to me in this one is, and this kind of pointed out the difference in experience that I think Adam and I had for the 2014 book. And it said, its current favorite is the relatively recent lifestyle center retail phenomenon. These places are small towns that function as open-air malls, catering to chain boutique stores, interests, and focused on restaurants and mass market entertainment to keep shoppers of the center grounds for as long as possible. They're cookie-cutter, milquetoast places that give boring people just enough spice in their lives to make them feel interesting while still only featuring national branded chains with no cultural identity. Needless to say, the Weaver loves them. tell me what you really think, author. Yeah, the 2014 book very much has an opinion and a place that it's coming from in what it views as the threats that will bring about the apocalypse. And if you don't like that view, the 2014 book is going to be hard to get through. That's all I'm saying.
Well, before we move on, I need to explain terms for our listeners who aren't dedicated Werewolf the Apocalypse fans. Triad is the big three spirits. Terry and I were talking before we started recording, and he was telling me that some werewolf books describe them as higher Celestines, which I did not pick up from reading these three books, but these three books do mention the triad repeatedly and say that they are very important spirits in the minds of werewolf culture. You may have heard the weaver is stasis, the worm is entropy, and the wild is dynamism, but werewolves see things differently than mages. Werewolves believe the wild is a positive force when filtered through Gaia, the great earth spirit. This filtering creates new life, growth, wild places. Unfiltered, the wild is dangerous chaos. The weaver is a giant spider that went insane in prehistory. It wants to entrap everything and freeze it in a state of perfect order. Every physical object, every location, every idea in people's heads, I mean, just everything. The worm used to be balanced, but it went bad, and now it wants to corrupt everything so that it can destroy everything. Shenti is a term mages use. They are three immense realms in the deep umbra, one each for stasis, entropy, and dynamism. Anchorheads in the different layers of the near umbra lead to them, as well as to other places in the deep umbra. The Shenti have such a great influence on the universe that they cast reflections that are realms. Werewolves believe each Shenti has one reflection in the middle umbra. Mages aren't sure about how many there may be. So let's look at Kami. They get a chapter in the 2014 book, but no mention in the first two Umbra books. After 30 whole seconds of research, I found Kami probably started in the Werewolf Storyteller's Handbook from 1994. Don't quote me on that. What are Kami? When the worm places its power and influence in a person, you get a Famor, plural Famori. They're opponents in Werewolf the Apocalypse. We get different stats for them in different places so that werewolves can fight them. When the wild infuses an animal with its power, you get a gorgon. When the weaver does it, you get a drone. When television does it, you get a couch potato. When Gaia does it, you get a kami. Kami can be humans, animals, plants, or places, you know, locations, vicinities. Kami is singular and plural. Kami make a very interesting option for player characters. They have their own powers, but can also have spirit charms and werewolf gifts. I haven't had any in my games before, but as a storyteller, I'm open to them. The Rorqual of Blood-Dimmed Tides are one kind of Kami, and the chapter from the 2014 book could be used to make Rorquals more interesting in your games, although I'd keep Rorquals as NPCs, just my advice. Although I like the chapter, it is longer than it needs to be. The section explaining what Kami are could be a third of its length. We get example Kami. The whale Kami and the willow tree Kami are really cool. The others are less useful for my games. I thought it was funny to read pages about how Kami are filled with Gaia's love and then see a colony of bees that kills anything that comes near them and a woman who hates every person she meets. Kami help reinforce one of the original intents of the World of Darkness, and that is no moral assumptions. Werewolf fans and even writers sometimes fall into the assumption that werewolves are heroes and can do no wrong. Kami point out werewolves are not always in line with Gaia's will. I firmly believe that everyone is entitled to my opinion, so here it is. Kami is a poor choice of game terms. I feel for every World of Darkness storyteller who asks the players what their characters are and hears Kami from one. Oh, okay, politics are important, but are you a Kami mage, a Kami changing? No, K-A-M-I, that kind of Kami. You're a Japanese god? By that point, the player may flip the table. In my games, I would change the term to Gaian. Then it's clear to everyone. So that's Kami. I say give them a try. Terry, do you have any thoughts on Kami?
So the thing that I really liked about the Kami is it's kind of a reminder that werewolves or the Garou aren't the only thing going on Gaia's side. So the fact that they are still being produced suggests that Gaia is still active in some way, or there's some aspect of Gaia that still is, kind of like in the same way that 1E, the dream speakers were mortals that had been touched by Gaia that allowed them to awaken and use sphere magic. The fact that there's also these kind of esoteric creatures out there doing something, I think is another potent reminder. I also want to run a Kami Rorqual Dampier game at some point and just take all the rejects, all the weird absolute niche things, maybe with a low power mummy in there, and just have the weirdest table. You're like, what are you? I'm a werebee, or something like that. I also like the idea that the Kami don't necessarily understand their charge. I like the idea that it talks about plant and place Kami as only very slowly coming to understand what they need to do. So just that very slow coalescing, and to encounter a creature that's in the process of figuring out sapience and sentience, I think is kind of cool. And again, Gaia is hard to understand. So like, what does it mean when it says protect this parking lot? And you're like, there's only five Kami on the face. One of them's protecting a suburban parking. Okay, maybe we are lost. But I think that's kind of neat. I also like the idea of possibly there being temporary Kami where characters could receive a blessing. This is also kind of a model of what can be used when your characters want to interface or bargain with an Incarna of some sort, and gives an interesting framework of how mages could do that, because we don't have a great boon system for mage. We kind of get one in Infinite Tapestry, but I think you could really supplement with here. But yeah, terrible name, neat idea. And I also like the fact that it's like, these are super rare. Yes, we're giving you 30 examples, but you only need to use one. And I appreciate that, because normally in the World of Darkness, you kind of assume that everything is there unless told otherwise, as opposed to like Chronicles of Darkness, where it's assumed to kind of be a menu. It was interesting to see that kind of that technology of, no, just pick one or two brought in. The only weird thing to me was a lot of them didn't seem particularly powerful, and I thought they would have been. Like the whale, for instance, is no slouch, but some of the things where it's like, you get to start as a dandelion and you have two health, like I'm like I think I would want a little bit more out the gate. Like, you're a single ant, but that's just me. But yeah, neat idea, terrible name.
Yeah, I guess I got the general impression, just personally, after reading the Kami chapter and seeing the low power that so many of them start out with, it in my mind, it seems to imply that Gaia creates them and doesn't expect them to last a long time. And so when they fizzle out, she just creates more and more. And it's like, after reading the chapter, anyone would get the impression that, oh, Gaia doesn't do this very often, but it's a big deal when she does. So doesn't that imply that she would, you know, pack some power into them so they can keep themselves alive? But that's a nitpick, and it's not fair to bring that as a criticism against the chapter. I think the authors assumed that it would be like mortal tier characters instead of like werewolf powered character. And it's easy for those of us who are World of Darkness fans to look at the starting character stats and just, you know, turn up the knob a bit and, hey, it's good. That took what, less than 5 minutes? I'm ready to go. So yeah, I say give Kami a try. I think they're a cool idea. I think they're an interesting mixture of abilities and powers, and it leaves door open for the player to tell you about their character instead of being told, this is your group, this is what they believe, and if you step out of line, a whole bunch of people are going to be mad at you. And so, yeah, I like Kami. Open, ready to be written by the player.
Yeah, and the theory that Kami should exist within a game is known as communism. So that's not going to cause any... I just made that up, so...
Oh, darn it. I was trying to be a serious host, but I can't with Terry. Okay, well, each Umbra book has a chapter for spirits. The 1993 book had totem spirits that most mages won't meet. Also, a lot of spiders for the weaver and shapeless clouds for the wild.
So many clouds.
The 2001 book had an interesting mix of spirits. I would use several in the middle Umbra of my games. For an even better source of spirits, look at Axis Mundi. And of course, Terry and I did an episode for you of that. So Terry mentioned that. The Spirit chapter in the 2014 book was not my favorite. At first, I thought it was kind of doofus comedy. As I continued to read, in my opinion, it got worse. I think the developer should have ordered a rewrite, but of course, my opinion is very different. Your mileage may vary. Beyond that, the author's personal biases are writ large here, and most of the spirits leave me wondering how to use them in a game or why players would even want to interact with them. In all three books, we see geomids that serve the Weaver. They are three-dimensional solids, like a giant dodecahedron just floating in the air. And I think they are too abstract for the Middle Umbra. And personally, I think they're too abstract even for the whole werewolf game, regardless of the edition. Epiphs are spirits that manifest a concept. I like them, but I would place them only in the High Umbra. We have to remember the werewolf, the apocalypse, uses only one layer of the Near Umbra. When writers come up with new ideas, the Middle Umbra is where they're going to go. So, Terry, any thoughts on the spirit chapters of the three books before we move on?
One of the nice things about this is it gives a clear outline of kind of the spirit hierarchies. Mage has a very confused relationship with how it tends to present those. So, for instance, Book of Madness Revised has the Balt Mikado hierarchy, which I to this day cannot make sense of in terms of what it is. But here it's very clearly, and M20 tried to bridge the two between werewolf and mage and didn't quite. Like, I did a lot of work in my shameless plug, Other Worlds Explored, trying to explain how to make the mage hierarchy and the werewolf hierarchy and kind of the other hierarchies make sense. But the idea that you have Celestines out there, they are both the spirit and the object. Helios is the sun. Luna is the moon. And the destruction of one would be the destruction of the other, which implies that you would need to blow up the moon, which is why the Void Engineers existed, especially in first edition, and that they have their emanations, that no one ever deals with the Celestine directly, that you have the Incarnae, who are their emanations. The moon has a dozen, from Corn Maiden to Phoebe to the Japanese rabbit spirit, that are all out there. And then they have the idea that that is kind of the hierarchy from one direction. And then from the other, you have gafflings. You just have these little sentient spirit things that when an object is created, there's a tiny bit of spirit in it, and it kind of represents the object, that over time it can kind of grow in power and develop itself. The tank that's been used in 100 battles, the garden that's been carefully tended, the weaving equipment that's been passed down through generations will develop a sentience or a sapience to itself. That will be recognized by some greater spirit, and it can either be elevated or merely grow to its own size from a jaggling to a gaffling or a gaffling to a jaggling. I can never remember which. That middle realm of power is huge, from something that is a slightly intelligent doorstop to something significantly more powerful than an archmaster. It's got a fat power band in there, and just kind of keeping an idea that the spirit power kind of comes from two directions is important. But yeah, werewolf has a lot more types of creatures that are enumerated. We get anglings, which are creatures of hunt that are used to that are summoned to before a bunch of werewolves may do something. Adam had a write-up in our discussion in Nexus Mundi on how Adam would use that in a mage campaign, including the Hind of Cernunnos, I think. Something that mages chase after to get quintessence. Anyway, it was a good write-up and I remembered it, so good job, Adam. And yeah, the fact that since there's only one umbra that werewolves deal with, you kind of have to translate everything into it. But even in Mage, it's kind of interesting that frequently we will get a mid-umbral spirit that will be the spirit of a thing, and then a high-umbral spirit that'll be the idea of a thing. So you can have a spirit of blue in both locations, but one is how blue makes you feel, and one is the social and cultural associations with blue, and both of them can kind of exist. But yeah, it's interesting how werewolf tries to make everything fit. The other thing about werewolf spirits that I like is there are a lot of them. They tend to be circumscribed, as in they kind of have a specific thing, where in mage they tend to have larger remits and be more powerful on average. So it's interesting seeing that. My honest recommendation, if anyone is ever having trouble keeping track of the spirit hierarchy and how it works, go to the wiki. It's got a lot of examples. It's got a lot of links. I'll include a link in the show notes.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great when we can offer those resources to our listeners. We're not just full of opinions, we're also full of help, or at least sometimes. Mostly opinions. But anyways, When I look at how the three Umbra books for Werewolf depict the Middle Umbra, a few thoughts occur to me. Wild storms are spirit storms that occasionally move through the Middle Umbra and tear the place up. Werewolves assume spirits of the wild are the cause of wild storms. Mage books mention umbral winds. These winds may be caused by distant wild storms. These storms can be used as hazards to make your game sessions exciting. There are no systems, but a basic familiarity with World of Darkness rules should be enough for a storyteller to handle these. Wild storms cause the landscape of the Middle Umbra to change and are probably part of the reason the Umbra remains mysterious to mages. It justifies making the Middle Umbra difficult to navigate every time it appears in your games. Mages aren't supposed to get comfortable on this layer of the Near Umbra. Some mage books suggest only certain factions of mages can visit the Middle Umbra or function effectively there. I'm not that strict in my games. I agree certain mage factions will have an advantage in the Middle Umbra, but I don't think mages should be kept out. Humans are residents of Earth, and thus among Gaia's children. They can visit the Middle Umbra, but I agree many won't consider it or know much about it. It should be remembered Middle Umbra spirits descend from Gaia and the triad of Weaver Wild Worm. This gives a guideline for storytellers on how to line up spirits for your players to meet. As a storyteller, this helps me make spirits different between the High and Middle Umbra. Middle Umbra features spirits of nature and fundamental natural forces, such as stasis, entropy, dynamism. The High Umbra has more spirits tied to people, society, and abstract ideas. That's because the spirits of the High Umbra descend from human thoughts and feelings. This arrangement works for me because although dynamism, etc., do act on humans, I think they have a much stronger influence on the world as a whole. I can put a realm tied to entropy in the Middle Umbra, while the High Umbra will hold realms associated with what people think of entropy, more specific realms of death, forgetting, etc. When werewolves make agreements with spirits, it's called kiminage. I'm going to guess on how that's pronounced. It's basically, do this for me and I'll do this for you. Hermetic mages have been cutting deals with spirits for centuries and are supposed to be quite good at it. Would werewolves be offended when they notice their spirit friends are doing things for mages they don't do for werewolves? If they found out, would their understanding of their spirits be turned upside down? I would explore that angle in a crossover game. Finally, I think it's stunning how little was added to the Middle Umbra over the course of 21 years. The Near Realms are the same lineup. I can see why they didn't remove any, but why not add some? After reading all three books, I feel like the vibrant, ever-changing Middle Umbra got a little static. Terry, anything to add on the Middle Umbra portrayal before we move on?
The weirdest thing to me is there's no spirit wilds. Like, there's no space between the realms, really, that gets discussed. Like, in Mage, they talk about the Middle Umbra being this vast spirit wild that contains all creatures, possibly full of bygones in different places, with towering mountains and plunging ravines and every possible type of landscape. And then within them, you follow paths that are thematically tied to get to the Near Realms. But it felt real weird that Werewolf didn't have that, or at least I didn't pick up on it. So one of those two. The description of how to navigate between I appreciated, especially in the 2014 book where it really focused on the sensory experience. It does a great job of how to paint a picture of remember to include smells, remember to include tastes, remember to change it up between visits. These are the things that you're going to encounter. Everything is dripping with meaning and symbolism, and that should be apparent at all times. I like that Werewolf gave clear navigation rules on how to get from point A to point B and what that should look like, where Mage tends to be a little bit more hesitant to just provide a system. The Werewolf authors seem to recognize that it is perfectly easy to have role-playing and a system coexist, that one doesn't replace the other directly. I go back and forth on whether there should be new stuff in the Middle Umbra. Like, we were spoiled because of Infinite Tapestry, because the author's like, oh yeah, this weird thing happened at the Umbra. Look at all this new stuff that seemingly popped up that's been there the whole time that we just forgot to tell you about. Like the fact that the Fortress of Government is completely redone. They're like, doo-doo-doo, poof.
we have the idea that we have the near realms. They're the 13 ones. They've been established. Cool beans. But we do get the idea that there are these other places. Like, we have the realms that are kind of attached to the near realms. I wish we had a little bit more on what those could potentially look like. We get a few vague references. I do kind of like that. But yeah, another 15 of those little guys, I think, could have given the Umbra that feeling of dynamism that we wanted, that it's kind of moving in and out, or it's big, or it's hard to navigate, or something like that. But yeah, I think the real meat of the discussion of Middle Umbra is when we talk about the near realms later.
I want to talk now about translating werewolf material on the Umbra to Mage the Ascension. I'm a big picture person by temperament. I won't go into specifics about translating werewolf material to Mage because it would take a long time, and most of it probably wouldn't apply to your games. If I have general guidelines to apply, I can usually work out the details I need. So I'm going to keep my thoughts at a higher level, at least try to. It must be remembered that werewolves are half spirit, half physical being, while mages are fully residents of Earth. Werewolves are half human and half animal. I should say were creatures are half human and half animal, while mages are fully human. Werewolves in the High Umbra should be out of their depth. It's a place for humans. As for the Middle Umbra, I think of it this way. Werewolves have a summer home and a winter home. When they're in the Middle Umbra, they're basically moving from one to the other. Earth is like the village for mages. The Middle Umbra is a wilderness for them. They can find knowledge and resources, but they're never going to be at home there. Technology and science are intrinsically connected to the Weaver and Stasis in werewolf books. This is not true in Mage. Technology can be influenced by or used for stasis, dynamism, or entropy. Werewolves have a basic tribal culture that has had very little change over the course of thousands of years. They see modernity as a bad thing they wish would go away. Mages are connected to humanity and react to modernity in a variety of ways. What this means for us is when we see technology joined at the hip to the Weaver in werewolf books, we may need to rework things. Dare I say it, werewolves aren't always right in their assumptions. The triad of great spirits make the principles of stasis, entropy, and dynamism foundational for werewolves. They view everything through that lens. For mages, these are basic principles that have some mystic significance, but nothing like it is for werewolves. The result of this is the three Shenti realms are the primary forces at work in the Middle Umbra for werewolves. Mages will probably see things differently. Instead of the worm attacking a realm, it may be a natural result of the realm being near the border with the Low Umbra. The crumbling apart of everything there may not presage destruction, but be an eternal part of the realm's nature. Werewolves think dystopia is a realm linked to the Shenti of Stasis. Dystopia, of course, is the like cyberpunk future city realm in the Middle Umbra. But mages may disprove that. Cultural inertia doesn't define the world for mages. A key difference between the two games is werewolves see entropy as a personality, a villain that must be defeated. Mages see entropy as a natural force. It does harm as well as good. We don't see gravity as an enemy that must be attacked, unless you're as overweight as I am. No, we see gravity as a part of the world we live in. We adjust to it. We only complain about it when we're making jokes. Mages take a more dispassionate, intellectual look at the Umbra. They really won't get the eternal crusade of the werewolves. When taking things from werewolf books and using them in your games, make them less personal, less about conflict. I think this opens up all kinds of possibilities. Instead of fighting off Weaver spirits to get somewhere when you're climbing the pattern web, mages can learn more about the patterns of a city or the nature of electronic networks by talking to stasis spirits. When you're running werewolf, the worm is real. When you're running mage, entropy is impersonal. If you're running a crossover, what about a third option? Beings in the Deep Umbra are trying to weaken Earth so they can break through the horizon and seize Earth. The players learn together to push past their tribal beliefs and intellectual assumptions. The worm is real, but there are several of them, and they never had anything to do with universal balance. Entropy is not a benign principle, but a force that is too active because outsiders are stirring it up. I'll finish with some thoughts on making the Middle Umbra unique. You'll want to use it if there are things mages can do there that they can't in the High or Low Umbra. For me, the Middle Umbra is about geography, nature, and directly affected by the principles of stasis, entropy, and dynamism. I'm going to toss out some examples to make this more concrete. A river is causing havoc in an area. Attempted solutions seem to be blocked by the river itself. It's like a living thing fighting every dam, redirection, etc. The penumbra isn't enough to contact the river spirit. Its home in the middle umbra allows mages to interact with it. Once there, the river spirit tells them the problem is the pattern web. It is threatening the river. This can only be dealt with in the middle umbra, where the pattern web manifests directly. Talking to nature spirits from the book Axis Mundi may be a part of the solution. Let's talk paradigms. A dream speaker solves the village's problem by talking to the spirit of the mountain. A son of Aether solves it with a weather machine. Different paradigms, but equally valid. The son of Aether has no need to visit the middle umbra. Now, what if the spirit of the mountain really is the issue? Now the dream speaker's paradigm is better equipped to solve the problem. I like to show the players at times how paradigms are not different packaging for the same thing. They can have different strengths and weaknesses. This also reinforces the practice of mages from different groups forming cabals that work together. If universal principles act more directly on the middle umbra, then mages who want to experiment with them or travel to the Shenti realms will pay more attention to the middle umbra. Maybe this is why the technocrats set up shop in Dystopia. That's in Book of Worlds. Perhaps raiding Autochthonia, sometimes depicted as the headquarters of Iteration X, requires starting in the middle umbra. Top-down, big-picture thinking helps me bring the middle umbra into my mage games. Arranging the cosmology of the world of darkness helps me understand how to use the umbra in my games. Don't just take the mage book's word for how the umbra is ordered. Make it work for you. Bending the universe to your will is a mage-worthy enterprise. Well, I think the listeners have heard enough from me. Terry, talk about translating werewolf to mage.
So the things I come away with tend to be a little bit more on the systematic side. For instance, one of the things that I thought was interesting is spirits in werewolf are frequently weaker. Like, if you look up spirits in mage, it's not uncommon that they will have essence pools between 40 and 100. Those are almost never seen in werewolf whatsoever, which I appreciated. I think that is a way in mage of giving entities like plot armor, of making it so that the djinn that you've introduced is really hard to get rid of or something like that. So it's interesting that spirits and werewolf are often weaker, at least on that notional level. And mage just kind of papers over the fact that it wants you to use this as a plot device by giving it really high stats so that your players can't really go around it. But I would be hard pressed to say that werewolf then makes it more combat focused. Like, again, they want the back and forth. In werewolf, the spirits often have pretty interesting charms. So that is kind of the thing that I would grab. So spirit charms are the mechanical way that we represent the power and ability of a spirit. And we also got a bunch of these in Bygone Bestiary, so don't hesitate to use that. Like, if you have a Paradox or Enigma or Discovery Spirit, give it the ability to answer one simple question once a day or something in exchange for 2 points of willpower or something like that, or an offering of a secret. The other thing I liked is werewolf generally gives a lot more detail about what interacting with a spirit looks like. I think it was the 2014 book where we got a bunch of encounters that showed what it looked like from the spirit side as well as from the werewolf side. And I thought that was an interesting elucidation where this is how the spirit works. The other thing is werewolf tends to make spirits much more quirky in specific ways, which I appreciated. One of the spirits is listed as not liking proper titles or proper names and being kind of offended by that. Other spirits don't like the notion of using a past tense. And I think that is vastly more evocative than a lot of what we get on the mage side. Mage, especially in M20, tends to focus on the idea of respect when interacting with spirits, where werewolf is generally recognizing spirits as just another type of being that is kind of like them. I'd be perfectly fine in a mage game of mages doing the same thing. I happen to be flesh and blood, you happen to be ephemera. Who cares? Especially if you're dealing with a paradigm that is, say, for instance, computer focused. I'm made of flesh and blood and you're made of data. That doesn't make you any less of a person. The werewolf view of the triad I find interesting because, like, people are like, mages tend to be more dispassionate, but like, mages personify paradox and technology and discovery all the time. So I think that's going to vary from mage to mage. Like, mages tend not to personify oblivion, but in the game, the agents of oblivion are very much real. We call them the Nafandi. So like, that is where that personalization comes in. But I would be perfectly fine if a character talks about entropy in a very similar way to how werewolves would talk about the worm and its active destructive part. Like the whole idea of being a Celestine is you are the thing in addition to the personality behind it. As Adam mentioned, the werewolves view everything through that lens of the three elements of the triad. Add that to your mage game for the important paradigmic elements. Maybe your chronicle is about the costs of urbanization or about the difficulties of moving forward. Create Celestine elements that represent advance and another one that represents tradition. So instead of the Weaver Wild and Worm, you now have Lord Tradition and Dame Progress who are waging a war through the Middle Umbra or the Penumbra that is being represented there. Another thing Werewolf does is it frequently treats spirits as having a static difficulty to overcome. So for instance, to get past Kerberos, you're not rolling your wits plus subterfuge against Kerberos's perception plus empathy. It says roll wits plus empathy against difficulty 9, you need 4 successes. And just translating things to static difficulties, I find vastly easier to run at a table. That way I don't need to stat out a character, which I kind of liked. Werewolf also gives interesting things that just kind of exist in areas that are useful to find. The closest to this we ever got was an infinite tapestry where we got the idea of areas granting boons. There's nothing preventing you from just kind of strewing wonders about the other worlds, and that gives a real concrete reason to go out there and do it. Your characters need a void stone. They need a gem of memory. They need the cloak of night or something like that. Just kind of have it be a thing that they can pick up there that has some natural ability that you can bring back. In Mage, we have perfected objects. We have higher umbral objects as a class of wonder that you get from the high umbra that do their job perfectly or in a particular way. I have no problem just having them be in the setting that the characters don't need to spend XP for it. That's the reason they went to this particular place. My last idea is Werewolf really brings up the idea that the Penumbra is really where the action takes place. If you want to have a world where that's really where the Ascension War is shown, you can do that too. Werewolf has a much more direct and well-explained connection between how the spirit reflection of the thing and the thing interact between one another. Mage, it's a little more tenuous. We get like one rote at one point that talks about how to do an umbral quest to change something in mundane reality. So another thing we can get from Werewolf is an idea of how those two are in communication with one another. And I find that useful and interesting, especially if you're going to have a game that has access to a shallowing or a node with a very low gauntlet rating, or that plans on spending a lot of time in the Penumbra. And those are my thoughts on translating Werewolf to Mage.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were speaking that I think in the past, in all the editions of Mage, I think I get the impression anyways that Mage authors had this fear of making talismans, wonders in Mage look too much like magic items in D&D. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, we can't have the cloak of hiding because then it gets too much like D&D, and wouldn't that be awful? And in werewolf books, it's like, hey, if you go to this realm, you can find wild stones. Put one in your backpack, take it home. You can do cool stuff with it. It's like, that sounds like fun. Why don't you do that?
I feel like one of the recurring themes looking through this book was like, hey, that sounds like fun. We can do that.
Yeah. In some of the newer OSR fantasy RPG books, there's this notion of like the rock you find in the distant land that if you do spells while standing next to it, your spells go funny and unexpected things happen. And yeah, wild stones in Werewolf, you go to the Flux or something and you get a wild stone and you bring it home and, you carry it around. And when you try to do magic, it goes funny. But other people, when they do magic, it goes funny. And you could have very interesting things result from that. Some good, some bad, which is appropriate for something called wild. But yeah, guess specific.
It kind of brings back to Mage has a problem with, because everything is through the lens of paradigm, Mage is very hesitant to make a part of the world true and magical at the same time. It wants everyone to be right about all things at all times. So it tends to be hesitant to have those natural items out there, which I get, but if we break that assumption, we do get these cool things. I think my favorite example of that is in Infinite Tapestries. It suggests that wonders spontaneously appear in areas where the Inventium and another place kind of overlap. I just kind of like that as an idea, that it gave the storyteller carte blanche to be like, this someone somewhere is working on this idea, and it is reflected in the Umbra, and you are able to temporarily get the umbral reflection of that, and that allows you to have a magic item or its analog temporarily until its ephemera kind of fades. So, Mage the Podcast, it's okay if you want to add a magic item. We're not going to stop you.
Yeah.
Well, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review of Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in their searches. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes. We have a YouTube channel now where you can find our episodes. There's a link in the show notes, but you can also search YouTube for Mage the Podcast, all lowercase. Don't sweat the colon. You'll find us. We're also on Mastodon. A link is in the show notes. This episode is very appreciative of the help we got from executive producers. Terry, can you share their names with us?
I would be glad to. And remember, when this was recorded and when this is going out, maybe far apart from each other. So if you hear your name and you stop supporting us, you get by this time. If you didn't hear your name and you are supporting us, we love you. We love you even more than that other guy that stopped. No, that's not the case. We appreciate all of our listeners. But anyway, special thanks to Oracle Ben Bendelow, Oracle Buck Gregory, Oracle Christopher Phillips, Oracle Guy Stewart, Oracle Jay Widener, Oracle Josh Hillerup, Oracle Mikhail, Oracle Puka G, Oracle Sean Gallagher, Oracle the Crew of Erebus, Oracle St. UX Player, and Oracle Sorcerer Sanguine, along with Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Sensick, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Michael Parker, Archmaster Morgan Aron, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, Archmaster Wolf Larryson, Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Baderfi, Berto, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Bubba the Pale One, Chris Blake, Sinchotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Swank, Fragerwalk, Friedrich Al, George Laura, Henry Kraft, Ia Bull, Jason Kennedy, Jason Vines, Jason W. Briggs, Jake Atsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., Jervis Johnson, John Magnuson, Jolin Andes, Lawson Stuff, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Manel Canos, Michael Prohl, Michael Creedle, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Patrick McNamara, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ruben Joseph, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Sev Nessus, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Thank you so much for your support.
If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes like this one. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The links in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
And remember, if you're not quite sure what to do and it happens to involve a World of Darkness game, chances are it's been opined by at least two different lines in at least three different books. And use our affiliate code. Bye.